Hello and welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. I'm your aptly named host. I ran a bit to get here. We have a listener of the week. They're big, big fans of Nonprofit Radio, always sharing posts on Twitter. Give local America. This week they tweeted, "You know we're going to RTU. We're fans and can't help ourselves." I love this. Follow them on Twitter. They are at GiveLocal15. In 2014, $53 million was raised. They're out to smash that in 2015. Give Local Day this year is May 15th. Give Local America, thank you very, very much for loving Nonprofit Radio. I'm glad you're with me, because I'd be hit with actinic keratosis if I got exposed to the idea that you missed today's show, Mastering Millennials. Derek Feldman, co-author of the Millennial Impact Report, shares the research on how 20 to 32-year-olds connect, get involved, and give to causes that they're passionate about, that originally aired on December 13th, 2013. Also, your board calendar. What belongs on your board's calendar and agendas? What should they be discussing? Which actions should they take? Gene Takagi is our legal contributor and principal of the Nonprofit and Exempt Organizations Law Group, NEO. On Tony's Take Two, a social change e-newsletter, and my latest stand-up comedy gig. We're sponsored by Generosity Series, hosting multi-charity 5K runs and walks, and here is Mastering Millennials. Derek Feldman, co-author of the Millennial Impact Report, shares the research on how 20 to 32-year-olds connect, get involved, and give to causes they're passionate about. We're improvising a little bit right now because Derek Feldman, who wants to be in the studio, is supposed to be in the studio, isn't in the studio, but he's on by phone in a cab. We'll find out exactly where he is. Derek Feldman leads the research team on the Millennial Impact Project and is CEO of Achieve, a consulting company. He co-authored Cause for Change, The Why and How of Nonprofit Millennial Engagement, published by Wiley. He writes for Philanthropy News Digest of the Foundation Center and the Huffington Post Impact Channel. On Twitter, he's at Derek Feldman, spelled with two N's. Derek Feldman, welcome.
Thanks so much, Tony. I think I'll be there with you soon.
Okay, where are you? Tell me where you are.
Well, I'm by the tunnel, so on the west side of the city, and so I think I'm about 10 minutes or so, or 8 minutes.
Okay, the tunnel, which tunnel? We have a bunch of tunnels. Which tunnel are you near?
Lincoln.
Oh, my God. What time did you leave? Where'd you leave from? Indiana?
I think, it's a lot of traffic, but I'll be there, I promise. Don't worry, we'll get there soon.
Okay, all right. No, that's okay. We can improvise by phone, and then we'll get you here when you get here. Why don't you tell us why we should even be studying millennials? Why did you?
It was an interesting time as I was looking at how to understand how to connect with just donors in general. About 5 years ago or so, I looked at how we can help clients and individuals better engage just donors in general. And one of the most interesting things that as I started to do that, I realized that millennials, those in their 20s and early 30s, although some disagree where the cutoff is, but roughly in their early 30s, 31, 32, I started to see some interesting differences between how their connection preference and how somebody who is a boomer had a preference to as well. And I thought, boy, if these are the donors of the future, we better start trying to understand what their expectations are as supporters. So that's kind of how it kind of got me interested in the discussion.
Okay, and what's the history of the research? You've been at this for several years.
Yes, so we are embarking upon the fifth year of the research. We've had the last 4 years, we've really focused and brought down that sort of engagement to focus on, as you mentioned, how they connect and then how they involve and then how they give. We studied marketing, communication messages, solicitation approaches, and so forth. And so the study, the report in 2013 was the fourth year of the study. And next year, we will be studying in partnership with the Chronicle of Philanthropy how millennial alumni are engaging with their institutions, why or why not, some of their expectations as well. And then in addition to that, be focusing on the corporate cause engagement side. to how employees, millennial employees in particular, are viewing their cause engagement through their company and what they want to see have happen.
Okay. So we're talking about the ages 20 to 32, right? Is that, that's what your research
Correct.
Was? Okay.
Yep.
I know there's some, you, as you mentioned, there's some, you know, questions about where the age cuts off or whatever, what's a Gen Y, what's not, but your research was 20 to 32.
Correct.
Okay. Okay. And I'm sure that there are differences within that group even, right? I mean, a lot of 20-year-olds are not like most 32-year-olds.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is something that we've had to look at overall when it comes to even social media engagement, and I'm sure Amy can talk about that as well. The first year that we did the study, high usage of Facebook, and even in our own studies over the course of the 4 years, we have seen Facebook in the younger tier of the generation, those in their 20s to 25, that usage declining, high usage of Instagram, image-based type platforms like Pinterest and so on. And so there are differences between that. And even as we look at the upper end of that, right, so those that are in the early 30s, late 20s, where starting families and their philanthropic exploration is sort of right in the middle, I like to say. And they're at a time where it's not necessarily they're giving to a lot of causes, and they're starting to be much more sophisticated in their types of giving approaches. So it's a big age range, lots of changes going on. New technologies are always established that change some of this, but also in combination of those technologies, we see the actual individual going through their own philanthropic exploration as well.
Yes, okay. Studying it on an individual basis as well, right.
Absolutely.
Do you have any objection to the term Generation Y?
No. And in fact, you know, if you're one that likes generational terms and letters and so forth, that's great because we had X and Y, and then some are calling it Z in the next one. No, not at all. I think the one thing that we are, you know, seeing is this trend of a discussion around, you know, do we have to just label, you know, millennial, or is it just somebody who's in their 20s or even a young adult and so on? I think that we'll move away from the term millennial in the next, you know, 3 or 4 years. Our studies will look at other things, but if in terms of just using that name and nomenclature, it does help some people understand which age group we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, that's the advantage of having phrases that everybody understands. So I was just curious. I mean, it doesn't matter to me. I'm happy to say millennials. I was just wondering if there was any objection you might have had to Gen Y or something. Okay. All right, so the first really sort of phase of long-term activity with a nonprofit is connecting.
Yep, absolutely.
What do we see among millennials in how they get connected and what it is that moves them to connect?
Exactly. So we have this is an important feature that as we were even looking at the continuum of involvement, right? So how somebody moves from hearing about a cause to pure action, what they're doing, and so on. We've sort of been in this mode that we have to help the millennial move along an educational component that helps them understand the issue, the cause issue, much more importantly than necessarily the institution or the organization in itself. And so what we have really looked at over the course of the last couple of years is how can we better position the cause issue to try and connect with millennial interests in order to get them to act or commit to the cause. And we have discovered that when the issue is really at the forefront, because that's what they're sharing, right? Shared common value and shared common issue, the individual tends to have higher reaction rates. So this would be an example of saying, if you care about giving water to everybody in Africa, you know, join us, participate. We're leading with the issue versus saying, this is who we are, these are the three things we stand for, all that other stuff, just like it's because you heard about the brand right now. And so we've got a little bit of differences between those, and the connection points have been much stronger when we focus on the issue.
Okay, interesting. So that's really the affinity is for the cause. Now, I just heard a little background noise. Does the cab driver know that he's in a recording studio?
He does.
He does.
He's been really great. So I have to give my cab driver a really good
Yeah, make sure. Yeah, give a generous. Make sure you give a generous tip, and if he's any kind of performer, ask him if he's a performer. Maybe he can be on.
well, he's right now really focused.
Okay. I don't know if he has his SAG-AFTRA card, so we may not be able to let him on if he's not in the union. We wouldn't be able to do it anyway. And in this connection phase, the millennials are how extensive is their use of an organization's website? And we have just like a minute or so before our first break.
Yeah, very, very, very important. We're seeing that one of the first things a millennial does is look at the digital environment in which they're attracted to from the issue. So here's a good sort of play on how we've seen action happen. Millennial is interested in the cause, some impulsive piece. It might be from a peer. They'll use Google. Move directly into a website digital environment. And from that environment, they do a couple key things. One is they're trying to figure out if the issue necessarily does match what they're wanting to do. The second thing is understanding how that organization or cause is related to that issue. And then third is it's going to a social network to see how they're talking. And so we've seen that happen time and time again as we do usability testing and so forth to watch them do that. What's also important in that, and I'll finish up real quick, is the high use of imagery to compel them to act and perform at least an action in that digital environment first.
Okay, excellent. There's a lot there. We'll stay on this exact subject. What that connect continuum looks like. It's very interesting. Going right to digital website, but then switching to social. Okay, stay with us.
You're tuned to Nonprofit Radio. Tony Martinetti also hosts a podcast for the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Fundraising Fundamentals is a quick 10-minute burst of fundraising insights published once a month. Tony's guests are expert in crowdfunding, mobile giving, event fundraising, direct mail, and donor cultivation. Really, all the fundraising issues that make you wonder, am I doing this right? Is there a better way? There is. Find the Fundraising Fundamentals archive at tonymartinetti.com. That's MARTIGNETTI. Remember, there's a G before the N. Thousands of listeners have subscribed on iTunes. You can also learn more at the Chronicle website, philanthropy.com. Fundraising Fundamentals, the better way.
Welcome back to Big Nonprofit Ideas for the Other 95%. Let's do a little live listener love. Mainz, Germany. Welcome. Live listener love to you. Hangzhou, China, and Shanghai, China. Ni hao. And Seocho, Korea. Annyeonghaseyo. I decided to start abroad with live listener love today. From a cab on the west side, somewhere between the Lincoln Tunnel and 72nd Street, Derek Feldman, co-author of the Millennial Impact Report, and we're talking about mastering millennials. So Derek, the nonprofit's website in the long term is not as important to the connection, but initially it sounds like it is important.
Yeah, it is. And Tony, you'll be excited. I'm actually here.
So you're downstairs. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So why don't you push the button for floor number two, and I'll just speak while you're on your way up.
Great. It's wonderful.
Okay. Derek has made it to the studio at 125 West 72nd between Columbus and Amsterdam. There was one time when Amy Sample Ward had to run. Frequent listeners will remember that, and she will remember as well. I know she's listening somewhere. She had a run here, and I did a little tap dance, and she was a little out of breath, but it was no big deal. Derek took the civilized way. He took a cab, so he will not be out of breath. He'll be all poised as soon as he walks in, and it's very exciting. I can hear the elevator door opening. Oh, and he did not take the elevator. Derek Feldman actually coming up the stairs, I'm pretty sure, didn't want to wait for the elevator because we're only on the 12th floor, so he's going to have... No, we're on the second floor. I don't know. He'll be here shortly. Can't tell whether he took the stairs or the elevator. The person on the stairs walked past. But so what's interesting about the use of the website is, as I was saying, it is important in the beginning, but then after that, it's a switch to the social platforms. So there clearly needs to be ease of transitioning someone from your site to Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, you know, however you believe you're going to be connecting. if you want to keep millennials engaged. All right, Derek is here. It's okay. He's a little out of breath, but he did take the stairs, and it's only a one-story walk. All right, looks cool. Welcome, Derek.
Hey there. How are you?
Great. Welcome. You're the second person to do this. Amy Sample had the same problem months ago when she was still here in New York. She had to run. Okay, so take a breath. We were just talking about. I was just recapping like the importance of the website and the importance of making sure that it's easy to jump from this website to the social channels, because that's what millennials want to do for the long term, for the longer term.
Absolutely. So what we'll also see from there is that we will watch a millennial initially take an action on a site, but it also has a sharing component. So it could be something like sign a petition and then share it with your friends, and then also going to their social networks to do things as well.
So quick call to action on the site.
Exactly.
On the website.
Exactly. Okay. Because what we really want digital sites to do is help the millennial commit to the cause issue. Right. So it's, if I want water, yeah, are you in for helping with water? A small action, and then also saying, great, now we want you to share your experience. This is where we share ours. You share ours too.
Okay. So the website becomes less important. You're not finding millennials going back to the website very much after first connection?
Correct. Really? Well, that's true. Yeah. And so the website has then become much more of a platform than to continue to act upon. So later on, there might be email campaigns, solicitations, those kinds of things. But
which would drive back to the website.
Exactly.
Okay. So if they're driven there, they're certainly going back. But if not driven, they're getting long-term information from the social networks.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yep.
Now, part of your study included video, right? You were watching people interact with nonprofit websites.
Yeah. We did user testing. And so besides us just saying, hey, this is what we found out, we thought we should actually put this stuff in front of millennials and get and record their reaction to it. So we had about 100 millennials nationwide that we put different types of solicitations in front of. Communication messages, digital experiences. We had them go through websites. Tell us what you like, what you don't like. Tell us what you didn't like with the solicitation. Why wouldn't you give, or why would you? And so all of that, we actually shared some of that on our site. We plan to do more and share more of that in the next year.
While I'm thinking of it, why don't you give the URL where people can find the research and download it?
Yeah. So all of the research is available for free. And thanks to the Case Foundation, Stephen Jean Case Foundation in Washington, who's really been helpful in allowing this for the field. And you can find that at themillennialimpact.com.
Excellent. Thank you. Since the website is important at the connection phase, should we be thinking about being mobile optimized if we're going to be optimized for millennials?
Absolutely. This is something that's been really interesting even around the text space. First year we did the study, Haiti happens within 2 weeks after we started. We thought, oh my gosh, the real research will be flawed. And later on, even in this year, when we look at text giving overall, it has remained, in that year we did the Haiti incident, it was 18% of our pool had text to give. This last year, we had about 18.5% that have text to give. So over the last 4 years, in our studies, and I can't say everybody else's studies, but in ours, we have found that it's been a little constant. What has risen during that time is the use of mobile engagement for transacting and so forth. So going to a mobile-friendly website and then actually donating or taking a cause action.
After connection,
of course,
comes involvement.
Exactly.
Right, what do we see around involvement generally before we get specific?
Yeah. So I think the trend about 8 to 9 years ago was, in the field at least, let's create a young professionals group. That was our way to get millennials and young professionals, right?
So segregated.
Yeah. I always like that. So in all good intentions, right?
Yeah.
We figured that if we create this group, they'll see their like-minded friends, they'll do certain things, and at the same time, they'll be able to actually learn from each other and get more engaged in the cause. But we were doing something very interesting, is that we were separating them from the true cause work of everybody.
Right.
So what we have discovered is this full integration together. And secondly, is that we have to, as causes, allow an opportunity for our millennials and, quite frankly, any age volunteer advocate to do things with us in a very short amount of time. So as you and I sit here right now, and if I wanted to do cause work for 10 minutes, I should be able to do that and have that opportunity. And millennials want that too. Millennials are wanting the opportunity to actually be together at times, but also independently work and do cause work throughout the day when they can. Doesn't necessarily mean I have to go down to the soup kitchen. How can I help the soup kitchen virtually as well? So that's the trend that we're seeing.
Okay. Also a lot of learning. If there is going to be volunteer work, I saw references in the study to learning online versus making learning online available.
Yeah. One of the biggest complaints millennials have told us is, you know, I go to a volunteer experience. The first half hour is you teaching me what I'm going to do. And their complaint is, I don't know if you know this, we live in an online environment. You can train us online prior to us getting there. You can wait, you know, it's an extra half hour you can
have. Like we wasted 30 minutes.
Exactly.
Okay. A lot of interest in connecting with like-minded peers, right? Seeing that as the reason for volunteering?
Exactly, right. And so the initial engagement with causes either happens by themselves or with peers. And peer engagement is really high. Peer fundraising is high with millennials and so on. And when it comes to peer involvement, it's the same thing. But here's where we get really challenged, is that our organizations are not necessarily set up to do peer involvement type service. So for instance, if they go to the soup kitchen, well, Randy, you're over there, Derek, you're over here, and you're over there. I know you all came together here and you wanted to do this as a peer thing, but we're going to separate you. And that's another complaint that we've heard.
When we talk about peer fundraising or peer-to-peer fundraising, are runs, walks, and rides popular with millennials? They are.
Very, very. And, you know, I think run, race, walk is an incredible opportunity to expose people to cause work. The question is what do we do with it after that? We had about 63% had participated in a run, race, walk. The highest, one of the highest fundraising components besides just giving outright as well, event-based style fundraising too. And so once we get this opportunity where we're bringing our friends, our peers all together, and this is where Amy can talk as well, is that then how do we convert that to true engagement? The thing that a board of directors will do is say, oh my gosh, Derek brought 10 of his friends. These 10 friends now love the Cancer Society. That's not true. They love Derek.
Yeah.
And they don't love necessarily the rest. And so we have to be really cautious. And we have always viewed, and we've put out some stuff there to say that you have to have a drip campaign to engage them back in the cause. Because in our, as you said, connect, involve, give, we've skipped connect, involve, and peer fundraising and went directly to the give. Mm. Now, sometimes we try to educate them as quick, but we haven't had them act on behalf of the cause except to give. So we got to rework it a little bit more and get them to act now to the next step.
Okay. And one of our sponsors, like to weave this in, is Rallybound, which does software for runs, walks, rides. You say, what do you say? Runs, races, walks?
Is that run, right? Walk, race. It's all, yeah.
Okay.
The rides is in there too, I think.
Yeah, rides. We got to work it all in. After we are we're connected, we're involved, now we get to giving. And again, generally, you know, what do you see from the group that, I mean, our population probably has the least available to give.
Right.
Cash-wise.
Cash-wise.
Cash-wise. I'm not, and that's not the only gift that people can give, of course.
Yeah. So I'm glad you mentioned that, because I do want to make a statement that as we have looked at millennials, they view all the assets they have as valuable to the cause.
Yeah.
And that asset goes the traditional form of philanthropy is time, talent, treasure. Well, I will have to come on here and say that there's actually an expanded view for millennials. It is skill that they have. It is the time that they have. It is the money they have. And the network they possess, their ability to tap into that network for you and their voice. I mean, they're considering all of those equal assets and opportunities for causes. When it comes to giving, we have seen that a substantial amount of the giving efforts have involved peers, as I mentioned a little earlier.
Right.
And what we do have, though, is this high level of transparency and expectation that there is some sort of feedback mechanism that will occur upon gift. And I'm not talking about the form letter that you get after you give, right? The 24-hour rule that we want to try and do. This is so we asked you to give us $10 to give a net to Africa, or, you know, help somebody, help an individual. Well, in 30 or 40 days, I'm going to report back to you how that net actually had an impact on that individual. and not waiting a long time on that reporting or that feedback, but actually bringing that shorter within the 15 to 45 day mark is what we're really looking at.
Oh, wow. Within 15 days.
Yeah. We or at least working on behalf of the cause. There's a great cause called Generosity Water, if you haven't checked them out. And online, they actually show the process they go through after they get your money. And the greatest thing any organization can do is communicate along the way. You might not have impact for a full year. It doesn't mean that you're not working on their behalf. And that's what we forget. And what
we think that the only thing our donors want to hear is
when it's completely done.
Job done, mission accomplished.
And we don't need
to
do that.
Oh my God,
that
was a George Bush reference. I didn't mean to do that. George Bush on an aircraft carrier, mission accomplished. Strike that. Job done.
Exactly.
That's not the first report. That doesn't have to be the first report. Job done.
Exactly. So, and this is where social media engagement is an incredible opportunity. We can say, all right, after you give, in 15 days, I'm going to communicate with you and say, you should check out our Facebook. Here's five images that are in our Facebook environment right now from the people that we're working with on your behalf. If you want to continued updates, head to our Facebook environment, because that's where we can give that to. I would never use the word environment, but you can see how we can use that social media engagement and say to our program people, I need you to take three photos of the beneficiaries this week so we can continue to update our donors in real time of what's going on and so forth, and show the people that we're actually helping in the cause. So we have seen that. I mean, the use of annual, every time we do this study, it happens every time. It's no annual reports. I don't want that physical thing. It just takes too long. But we have to look at how millennials are doing things in general on the consumer side, and just in overall, is that feedback loops in general have been much quicker. I mean, if you post something on Facebook and nobody responds to it, it's an immediate feedback, like, I shouldn't have posted that as well. So feedback overall in our society has been much quicker. I think the first time I took the GRE, it took me 2 months to get my actual score, right?
Yeah,
you had to wait in the mail. And then the last time I took it, which was a while ago, but it would tell you right there, are you ready to find out your score? And of course you freak out, right? In that moment, thinking, all right, life is going to be all dependent upon this next thing. But yeah.
How important are pictures and video?
Very, very important. Imagery, and Intent has been doing some great studies around this too, that imagery not only has higher reaction, posting, commenting, and engagement than just text does too as well. And overlapping text upon imagery, we saw really high remarks, high action rates. High action rates meaning either like, retweeting, or commenting or posting upon that.
Okay, excellent.
Derek Feldman is cursed because he was late in December 2013 when that originally aired. That caused me to be late today. It's unbelievable. I took a cab, and then we hit a red light, and I jumped out and ran for the last three blocks. And Derek Feldman, I blame you. Let's do some live listener love, because there's a ton. New York, New York, St. Louis, Missouri, New Bern, North Carolina, San Francisco, California, Cartersville, Georgia, Bethesda, Maryland. Live listener love to each of you. Podcast pleasantries, of course, to everybody listening to the podcast. And I think we'd better start adding affiliate affections, because we got lots of affiliates listening. So if you're not in the live, or you're not on the podcast, but you're listening from an affiliate, affection going out to you. And there's more live listener love coming. Tony's Take Two and Gene Takagi on your board calendar are coming up. First, I have to mention Generosity Series, because they host multi-charity 5K runs and walks. They offer a fundraising portal and a dashboard and all the social media tools that you need for the fundraising. That's why you're in the 5K run. And they have a charity support team that you actually talk to. These are people. This is not FAQs. People you talk to get help with your fundraising. And they handle all the details of the day, like the sound system and the start and finish arch and the permits and the medals and the licenses and the porta potties. What's a 5K without porta potties? Everybody's drinking water. You got to have those. So they put all this together for small and mid-sized nonprofits that wouldn't be able to host their own event. Events coming up in Brooklyn, New York, Northern New Jersey, and Miami, Florida. Talk to Dave Lynn. Pick up the phone. That's how I like to do business. He's a good guy. He's the COO at Generosity Series. He'll tell you how it all works. Tell him you're from Nonprofit Radio. 718-506-9777. Or, if you prefer, generosityseries.com. Nonprofit radio alumnus Jonathan Lewis hosts an e-newsletter I thought you might like to know about. It's about social change leadership. He's a very smart guy, and these are his thoughts about the sector. I read it. He's got sort of quirky headlines, but if quirkiness is not your thing, then look past those, because he has very good ideas. But if you love quirkiness, then you'll love his headlines too. And you can get his e-newsletter at cafeimpact.com. My stand-up comedy video from a show I did last month is up at tonymartinetti.com. Lots of stories that I tell. Seventh grade unrequited love and revenge. Very important. Dating and law school. That was a very, very good set. I felt very comfortable. I felt like it was my best set ever last month. And that's at tonymartinetti.com. And that is Tony's Take Two for Friday, 20th of January, 20th of February. I swear I need an intern so I can blame this bad copy on somebody. 20th of February, 7th show of this year. Gene Takagi's with us. He comes back every month. He's the managing attorney of NEO, the Nonprofit and Exempt Organizations Law Group in San Francisco. He edits the popular nonprofitlawblog.com, and he is at GTAK, GTAK, on Twitter. Welcome back, Gene Takagi.
Hi, Tony. How are you?
I'm doing terrifically well. How are you out there?
I'm doing great, thanks.
Wonderful. My voice cracked again. Like a seventh grader. Wonderful. We're concerned about our board's calendar this month. I think it's valuable to just refresh us. We haven't talked about this for a while. The fiduciary duty that a board has to the organization. Can you reacquaint us with that?
Sure. Well, in shorthand, Tony, you know, the board is ultimately responsible for everything that goes on with the organization. So looking back and seeing how the board was performing both in terms of compliance with the laws and in advancing its own mission and having enough money to do to carry on its activities, the board is responsible for that looking back, but it's also responsible for looking ahead for the organization and trying to figure out what's the best way to advance the mission going forward, and noting that the environment is constantly changing, fundraising demands are constantly changing, you may want to engage in new activities, the demand for services may be up. So you've got a lot on your plate as a board member. And the two legal duties that we talk about are the duty of care, of exercising reasonable care for somebody in the position of that type of responsibility, and the duty of loyalty, which means putting the best interests of the organization ahead of even your own interests.
And to carry out these duties, we, as board members, have certain things that we should be looking at month to month and every single year. And you have these sort of listed in a suggested board calendar.
Yeah, I published a short article LinkedIn about nonprofit board calendars, and that was just really to give nonprofits an idea of the type of recurring things that boards should be discussing. Of course, the board should itself prioritize what it believes are the most important issues with respect to the organization and get those on the calendar. But I think, you know, being a board member is kind of a strategic thing. We shouldn't just go in there in the meeting, sit down, listen to reports, and then rubber stamp whatever the executive director wants to do. I think we need to really plan ahead for what we need to get done. And, you know, if, as I said, boards are responsible for everything and they only meet a few hours a month or a few hours every couple of months, there's a lot to be done. And when things should be done is just as important as if they get done sometimes. So you want to make sure, for example, you approve a budget before the year is upcoming, so you can provide proper guidance to your executive about how to make its, you know, the expenditures, and a long list of other items.
Yeah, and before we get into all your recommendations that we have, you make a point that the calendar should be set in advance, right? There should be certain things set aside for each meeting back in you know, December, looking ahead, or January, looking for the full year, right?
Yeah, I absolutely do. I think before the end of the year, whether you're on a calendar year, and maybe to simplify things, we'll talk about a calendar year, in November, December, you should map out some of the important topics that you're going to emphasize at the next year's meetings, all of the next year's meetings, and plan it ahead.
Okay. And I'll tell you what, how can we get your LinkedIn article? Would you be willing to put that
on the Facebook page after the takeaways are posted this afternoon, would you put a link to your LinkedIn article in the comments to the takeaways?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great idea. So okay. I'll put it on the Nonprofit Radio Facebook page.
Exactly. Cool. Thank you. All right. So let's dive into some of these things that should be done should be done through the year. I like the one that is reviewing the executive director's or CEO's performance.
Yeah. And, as a board, we're obviously volunteers typically, and we're going to delegate management of the day-to-day operations of the nonprofit to a manager. We're not going to be there all the time. So evaluating the performance of the executive and how that person is carrying out the management of the organization may be one of the most important things that we have to do, including selecting and making sure that we have the right executive in place. But the performance review, I think, needs to be figured out soon after the year. So, again, you can provide proper guidance to the executive in a timely manner and not to delay that too long. So if we're on a calendar fiscal year, I think that's important discussions that you should plan ahead and get on the calendar for your January meeting.
And is this performance review delegated to the executive committee or some other committee, or because this is one of the most important, I think, activities. I mean, they're all important, but I think this ranks up there pretty high.
Yeah, well, so the discussion of the executive's performance should be done with probably the full board, so that the full board has a chance to provide input on this. Nonprofits range dramatically in how many board members they have and how
sure.
many committees they have.
Yeah.
So, you know, if it's an organization that has an executive committee or a governance committee, perhaps that committee can be delegated with actually carrying out the performance evaluation, but the discussion of the executive's performance should be done with the full board and probably, again, soon after the year ends.
Okay. And if it's a smaller board, how would the results of the discussion and the evaluation get conveyed to the executive director, CEO? How's that done?
Yeah, so a smaller board might want to delegate the task of actually verbally delivering the performance review to one or possibly two people, two directors, to provide to the executive director beforehand in terms of gathering all of the information. Sometimes that's done with a consultant in terms of figuring out how to what criteria you're evaluating the executive director on, not just financials, but also on programmatic results, also on the relationship and culture of the organization, on how they're prepping the board of directors and keeping them informed. There are a bunch of criteria involved, and so to have the right type of performance metrics for the board is really important. That might be developed by a separate committee of the board. Even if for a small board, they might assign that to like two or three or four people to really focus on that.
Let's move to the program evaluation, and I'm deliberately talking about that one before financials because, well, you and I spent a whole show once talking about the board's program review responsibilities, and sometimes it gets short shrift behind financial review. So I want to talk about programs first, okay?
Thank you so much for saying that, Tony, and reminding the listeners of that show as well. Nonprofits, as you and I both know, and I think everybody knows, when they really think about it, don't exist to provide to create a very high bottom line. They exist to advance their mission and carry that forward. So ultimately, you need the finances to make sure you're able to run those programs. But if the programs aren't actually creating any change or creating any benefit to the intended beneficiaries, then you're really failing as an organization. So
yeah.
reviewing
yeah.
the programs, along with reviewing the executive's performance, which will be based in part on how the programs are doing, is of tantamount importance. So yes, I think that needs to be reviewed very carefully. And difficult part about it is how do you measure impact? And I hear a lot of organizations go, well, you've got to develop, you know, metrics to get that done, and you've got to make sure that you're really advancing the solution to the problem. And so sometimes I think we might be asking too much of some smaller organizations. So for a smaller organization to provide metrics about how they are ending homelessness in the United States might not be appropriate for an organization that's really just trying to provide the bandage to feed the homeless in their local geographic area. And it's how well they're feeding those individuals or how many people they're feeding that might be really the basis of their mission. And they may be looking to other organizations to really solving the problem through policy and other areas. But providing the food has a great importance to feed the homeless in and of itself. And I don't think we should miss out on that when we're determining what metrics to measure. But figuring that out is a board responsibility.
I'm going to try to find that programs show where you and I talked when we take our break. I'm going to search my site and see if I can find the date for that show where you and I talked about programs. Let's move then to the financials. Is this something that should be done every? Is this done every month? And I know this is separate than the budget approval, which we'll talk about. But should we be looking at financials every single month? Every single meeting?
I think financials should be shared with the board in advance of every single meeting, and there's probably a small discussion that deserves to be taken place at every meeting, particularly financial performance versus budget, to see if things are going in line with what we expected or if they're going completely different, in which case we're going to have to revamp our plans and refigure out, you know, staffing and everything else. So a small financial review at every meeting, I think, is important. But a broader financial review after the year end, I think, is really important, because that can inform how we're going to create the budget and maybe the strategic plan, if you will, modify the plan for the year as well. So we do want to make sure that we're not going insolvent, that money is coming in as projected or better than projected, or we're able to reduce the expenses to make sure that we've got enough to cover everything.
Can this be part of a consent agenda where it's all reviewed in advance and then at the meeting everybody just approves that consent agenda and things can be done pretty rapidly?
Yeah, consent agendas are such time savers and such an efficient mechanism as long as you put the right things on that consent agenda. So if the financials are going exactly or very close to what everything was budgeted and there are no surprises in there, yes, it can probably belong on the consent agenda for the every meeting updates of the financials. In fact, you may not even need to approve the financials. So in that case, it's not really even part of the consent agenda. It's just part of the materials given out in advance and maybe a minute or two given for any questions that anybody might have about those financials. But there should be one meeting reserved for a longer review of the financial performance, and then certainly a meeting or delegation of budget approval that happens as well.
Let me give some live listener love, and then we're going to go out for a break for a few minutes. Honolulu, Hawaii, Falls Church, Virginia. And we have some live tweeters. Got to thank our listener of the week, Give Local 15. Thank you very much for live tweeting. And also Lori R. Finch. Thank you so much, Lori. Stay with us.
Like what you're hearing on Nonprofit Radio? Tony's got more. On YouTube, you'll find clips from his stand-up comedy, TV spots, and exclusive interviews. Catch guests like Seth Godin, Craig Newmark, the founder of Craigslist, Mark Echo of Echo Enterprises, Charles Best from DonorsChoose.org, Aria Finger of DoSomething.org, and Naomi Levine from New York University's Hyman Center on Philanthropy. Tony tweets, too. He finds the best content from the most knowledgeable and interesting people in and around nonprofits to share on his stream. If you have valuable info, he wants to retweet you. During the show, you can join the conversation on Twitter using hashtag NonprofitRadio. Twitter is an easy way to reach Tony. He's at Tony Martinetti, MARTIGNETTI. Remember, there's a G before the N. He hosts a podcast for the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Fundraising Fundamentals is a short, monthly show devoted to getting you over your fundraising hurdles. Just like Nonprofit Radio, Tony talks to leading thinkers, experts, and cool people with great ideas. As one fan said, "Tony picks their brains and I don't have to leave my office." Fundraising Fundamentals was recently dubbed the most helpful nonprofit podcast you have ever heard. You can also join the conversation on Facebook. where you can ask questions before or after the show. The guests are there too. Get insider show alerts by email. Tony tells you who's on each week and always includes links so that you can contact guests directly. To sign up, visit the Facebook page or TonyMartinetti.com.
Lively conversation, top trends, and sound advice. That's Tony Martinetti, Nonprofit Radio. And I'm Lawrence Pagnoni, author of The Nonprofit Fundraising Solution.
My goodness, I wish he would pronounce his name Pagnoni. Oh, kills me, Pagnoni. A little more live listener love. Let's go abroad. Osaka, Japan. Konnichiwa. Also in South Korea, Gunpo and Seoul. Annyeonghaseyo. Gene Takagi. The 990. The 990 review. And you like to see the 990 or think of the 990 as a marketing tool.
Yeah, I really do. And it's been... There's been a really interesting development recently. There was a gentleman named Mr. Malamud that filed a claim against the IRS to make sure that the 990s are all disclosable in electronic format and available for public view. Right now, you can go onto a nonprofit site, GuideStar, which I know you're familiar with, to look at 990s, but those are limited to the last 3 years unless you have a subscription, I think. So if the IRS is compelled to make them all digitized and searchable, that can really create new forms of looking at nonprofits at how well they're reporting, that they're making a difference in their communities. And you know, that will really increase the importance in terms of fundraising, in terms of building support, in terms of finding collaborators, because everybody will be able to just quickly look and scan through your 990s and find out what you're doing and what you say you're doing, and they'd expect you to put your best foot forward. So if it's done sloppily or, just without any care and to think of it just as a financial document anymore is really the wrong way to look at it. So I think the board needs to get involved and say, this may be something that every major donor and every foundation will start to look at quite carefully, and we should prepare the 990s that way.
Yeah, excellent thinking. Scrutinizing it like you would other marketing pieces.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also, it's signed under penalty of perjury by an officer. So
right.
Accuracy is therefore important. I want to remind us about two shows. First, I found the one where you and I talked about your board and its responsibilities around programs, and that was January 10th, 2014. The segment was called Program Your Board. And then on this 990 subject, I had a guest, Yeet Uchtoom, who's a CPA, and that was on the September 8th, 2014 show, and that was devoted to using the 990 as a marketing tool. And we went through section by section places where he felt you could put much better descriptions than just what you would do for if it was merely a financial compliance document, the way you're saying, Gene.
Yeah, let me say how critically important I think your show is in terms of sharing those resources out with nonprofits throughout the country, especially smaller nonprofits that I think really value it. So thank you, Tony, for highlighting that.
You're so thoughtful. Thank you very much. Well, you bring a lot of that to us. You know, people, you know, might say, well, why have legal every month? But you know, you put a color to it and a reality to it where the rubber meets the road, and it makes a lot of sense. And you avoid talking about the ethereal and the abstract, and so you bring a lot too, Gene. But thank you.
Thank you, Ted.
We love each other. See that? Well, I needed an alliteration for the San Francisco affection. let's see. Fundraising should also be reviewed, right? I mean, this obviously is critical to nonprofits. The board should be involved.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think every nonprofit has a different culture. And I've seen like really interesting debates, I'm sure you have as well, about the board's role in fundraising, about whether they should be actively involved. or contributing in some other way. But yes, every nonprofit board should be every nonprofit board member should give, I think, something that is meaningful to that individual board member. Don't want to exclude people from joining the board because of income or economic situations, but definitely a meaningful amount. And they can contribute in other ways as well, by providing volunteer services or acting as ambassadors of the organization. But I think having a discussion about the board's role in fundraising is something that should be done every year, and possibly bringing in a consultant and talking about things like planned giving. Don't you think that's important, Tony?
I do. Funny you mentioned. Yes, of course. Of course I do. We've had lots of guests talk about the board's role in fundraising, and they should be the leaders in any initiative, including planned giving, for sure. Also, something that the board should be looking at is a gift acceptance policy, if they're accepting gifts that aren't just cash in stock.
Yeah, you know, too many times I see provisions that boards put in bylaws that says, you know, things like, we will accept gifts of any type and any nature, and not provide any further guidance about that. And as lawyers, we're obviously terrified that some staff person might accept any gift, just as the board had said, we will take any gift. And some gifts are gifts you really don't want.
Oh my gosh! Yeah. I'm sorry, I interrupted you, but I'm thinking of this. The one client years ago was offered like a 3-foot strip of land that was disputed. So it was like 3 feet wide by 100 feet deep, and it was a dispute between them and the donor and their neighbors, and this was, they were trying to pawn it off on a charity. It was awful. Oh my God. So especially around real estate, but that's not the only thing that should be covered in your gift acceptance policy.
Yeah. I mean, there's some really interesting cases of like fine art as well. You know, if you receive a contribution of fine art, but you're told that you cannot sell it, and the maintenance costs of keeping that fine art are restricted in the grant agreement, so that you have to keep it at a certain barometric pressure and temperature, and it's got to be behind a certain amount of security.
Yeah.
The carrying costs of like, let's say you get a $1 million painting, you're so happy about it, but then you find out that it costs $50,000 a year to maintain it, and you're not allowed to sell it, and you're not a museum. And so what are you going to do?
Yes, yes. Gene, we have just a minute left, so you'll post the link to your LinkedIn article. Let's just finish with something that sort of subsumes everything we're talking about. Your board, in just a minute or so, your board really should be asking important big type questions.
Absolutely. So the board's role and the fear of management of the board's misunderstanding their role is if the board engages in micromanagement. The board's got to look at the big issues that affect the organization. Look at the past, as I said before, to make sure that their compliance and that the financials and that the program is really advancing the mission. But you got to think about looking forward, because you've got a vastly changing environment on all levels, on policy level, on legal levels, on fundraising levels. And you've got to look ahead and really take a look at the big picture and see the forest through the trees if you're a director on a board.
We have to leave it there. Gene Takagi, his blog is the nonprofitlawblog.com, and on Twitter he's at GTAC. And if you go to his site and read his bio, you'll see that he has very prominently in the first sentence of his bio, he mentions, Gene, thank you very much, that you are a contributor to Nonprofit Radio. It's right in the first sentence of your bio. Thank you so much. It's good to talk to you always.
Great talking with you, Tony.
Thank you, and I'm glad you're a part of the show. Got to do more live listener love quickly. Taipei, Taiwan joined us. Ni Hao. Tigre, Argentina. Iran and Caborca, Mexico. Live listener love to you. Next week, the convening world. We can do much better with, much, much better with conferences. And also a follow-up to the auctions and cash calls show last December. If you missed any part of today's show, find it on TonyMartinetti.com. Give Local America, they're our listener of the week. Thank you so much. On Twitter, they're at GiveLocal15. Thanks so much for your support of Nonprofit Radio. Our creative producer is Claire Meyerhoff. Janice Taylor is today's line producer. The show's social media is by Susan Chavez, SusanChavez.com. And our music is by Scott Stein. Be with me next week for Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Janice Taylor, what's happening with our Scott Stein music? Go out there and be great.
What's not to love about nonprofit radio? Tony gets the best guests. Check this out from Seth Godin.
This is the first revolution since TV 1950 and Henry Ford 1920. It's the revolution of our lifetime.
Here's a smart, simple idea from Craigslist founder Craig Newmark.
Yeah, in sites or in presentation or anything, people don't really need the fancy stuff. They need something which is simple and fast.
When's the best time to post on Facebook? Facebook's Andrew Noyes knows.
At traffic is at an all-time high around 9 a.m. or 8 p.m. So that's when you should be posting your most meaningful posts.
Here's Aria Finger, COO of DoSomething.org.
Young people are not going to be involved in social change if it's boring and they don't see the impact of what they're doing. So you got to make it fun and applicable to these young people, because otherwise a 15 and 16-year-old, they have better things to do. They have Xbox, they have TV, they have their cell phones.
Ami Dar is the founder of Idealist.
It took 2 or 3 years for foundation staff to sort of deign to add an email address to their card. It was like, it was phone. This email thing is weird. And plus, why should I give it away?
Charles Best founded DonorsChoose.org.
Somehow they've gotten in touch, kind of offline, as it were.
Yeah.
And they'll do exchanges of brownies and visits and physical gift.
Mark Echo is the founder and CEO of Echo Enterprises. You may be wearing his hoodies and shirts. Tony talked to him.
Yeah, you know, I'm a big believer that it's not what you make in life. It's you know, it's how you make people feel.
This is public radio host Majora Carter.
Innovation is in the power of understanding that you don't just, you know, just put money on a situation and expect it to heal. You put money on a situation and invest it and expect it to grow.
And savvy advice for success from Eric Saperstein.
What separates those who achieve from those who do not is in direct proportion to one's ability to ask others for help.
The smartest experts and leading thinkers are on Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%.